Pat. We had many conversations.
Yeah.
Of course, she was in a job that was my focus, was on energy and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, and she'd been in it with Bob Duncan, too, so in the middle of all of that.
Right.
Well, I'd like to record you.
Sure.
This is all eventually going to go into the ATIA archive. I take it and snip it up and
good.
Use okay. it for my own purposes.
Okay.
Would it be okay if I put it right here?
Sure.
Yeah, it'd be great. My voice carries it. Yours doesn't so much, so we'll put it a little closer to you. It'll be perfect. And I'd like to first thank you for the clippings. There's some really good stuff in there. The way that you get into it, I love the fact that you're doing news stories, these political notebook column kinds of things, and then going to the editorials. Just is a deeper, what kind of a three-dimensional image you usually don't get.
It's sort of my favorite type of writing is essays.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what these really end up being, because they always have some, even in the news stories, I always have at least some analysis kind of stuff.
Yeah, which is great. What I'd like to ask you is focus on your energy side.
Okay.
Because by the time ATIA becomes governor, energy's been an issue for a number of years at that point.
Right.
And he comes in and we're working on the Pacific Northwest Power Planning Council and, all those kinds of things. But take me back to before the oil crisis in 73. Reading your clippings, it's clear that there's a Northwest energy issue going on before we even know that's going to happen. Then that happens and, we have odd evens and all those kinds of things. But what was going on with Pacific Northwest energy and energy in general that you saw before the oil crisis?
Well, first of all, I think we had always this concern that when the federal dams were built,
mm-hmm.
it enabled the Pacific Northwest, all the residents, public and private users, to get their power, electricity, a lot cheaper than the rest of the country. And as time went on, congressmen representing the rest of the country would like some of this back.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big issues for all of the Northwest states, particularly Washington and Oregon and Idaho, were to defend the Northwest monopoly, I guess you'd say, on the Columbia River dams,
mm-hmm.
on the power. And they were fearful that, and this is involved governors as well as senators, although it was mostly the role of U.S. senators,
mm-hmm.
was to either trade off or influence or find some way to keep the rest of the country getting their hands off this power. Mark Hatfield, for example, one of the things he once told me was that he thought his best contribution to the state of Oregon was back in the Senate was not the things he did for Oregon, but things he made sure didn't happen
mm-hmm.
to Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
So it was always sort of in a defense mode. And this was true of Jackson, Senator Jackson from mm-hmm. Washington. It was also true of Magnuson, and true of Packwood, and even the Idaho senators, Church, and so forth. Anyway. I think Governor Tia had the same role because the state of Oregon had mostly private power.
Right.
And the dams primarily gave most of their benefit to public power users. And I hope I'm not simplifying this too much. But,
no.
In any respect, but yet, nonetheless, the private utilities also had a piece of the pie.
Mm-hmm.
And the last entity to get a piece of the pie was the aluminum companies,
yeah.
ironically, for which it was to the aluminum companies for which the dams really got built.
Yeah.
Because of war effort.
Yeah.
But after that, the argument could have been made more effectively that they didn't, they were helped, the war effort was over, and so their need to have cheap power was less important than federal taxpayers than the need for public and private users in the Northwest to have it. But in any respect, Oregon had to fight off all the time the tendency for public power to take over or to take a piece of the private power pie. Mm-hmm. And governors of Oregon, this is true, particularly true of Straub, actually went so far as to have I've forgotten the name of it now, it slips my mind, I'm sure it was in my clippings, an organization that would intercede and take a piece of the pie should certain conditions occur.
Was that the DRP or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I can look that up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Please, because I just forgot exactly the title of it. ATIA did oppose that.
Mm-hmm.
That particular organization. He didn't oppose the idea. He mm-hmm. opposed that particular strategy,
mm-hmm.
that particular situation. And so did the Oregonian, by the way. So that was one area where the governor and the Oregonian, and I guess you could say the governor and me, agreed that the Straub approach had negative consequences had it actually been implemented. And consequences that would have been dire to growth and to economic benefit of the state, particularly the private industries that mm-hmm. bought power from private utilities, PGE and Pacific Power and Light Company. There was also the issue on energy about how much of this. Hydro situation should be dedicated to the production of electricity versus how much should be held for the other sources of the Columbia River, mm-hmm. for example. The particular argument was that always brought every governor up in his chair was the demand by the tribes.
Right.
To have to cut down use of the dams for electricity, and it ended up a situation where the tribes started to compromise, and they would accept Bonneville Power Administration's plan on use of the dams in exchange for financial help on managing the hatchery system mm-hmm. all throughout the Columbia River.
Mm-hmm.
And one story that was, I thought, amazing about that, and I'm not sure how much the governor was involved or aware of this, but it was during his era, so he gave advice about it. It was simply that the tribes wanted Mark Hatfield wanted Mark Hatfield wanted the to pass a law that would allow the dams to have so many spills a year.
Mm-hmm.
At certain times of the year, and the tribes wanted those eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
It all got down to one debate where Mark Hatfield in a room with two or three of his staff and two or three Bonneville people, and I think somebody from the governor's office, I can't really comment on the names, I wasn't there, but the report which came to me was that meeting with the intertribe groups, the five tribes, cover it, Hatfield just asks him, well, what would it take for the tribes to accept our plan? Mm-hmm. And the head of the tribes, which I think was Ted Strong, but I can look this up. Anyway, the great answer was, after several seconds of thinking about it, the answer was $20 million. So for $20 million, the tribes compromised, according to the sources that told me. Mm-hmm. And the irony, again, about that is they never got it.
Yeah.
They never got to pay. And I think the governor may have approved this negotiation, but he never approved the idea of falling through on the deal.
Yeah.
Right. He made a deal. He was not like a lot of them. Mm-hmm. There was a constant worry about losing. The idea that Don Hoodell used to talk about, he was Bonneville Power Administration administrator for a long time, was that if it just with a press, it's just with a computer press of a button, you could transfer all the revenue into one big account, and then split it among all the states, mm-hmm. all the taxpayers in the United States, and lower everybody's tax bill by a mill or something, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
As opposed to the kind of benefits you get here. And of course, cheap electric power was pretty much what stirred our economy.
I mean, yeah. That's
what we had.
Yeah.
But then we had situations where California had problems, and then Bonneville would sell too much power maybe to them, and we had brownouts and things of that mm-hmm. nature. Mm-hmm. So we sort of grew up, the governors and the politicians in that era grew up with the idea that even before the Arab embargo of oil, that mm-hmm. that we were always threatened, always vulnerable to losing what was really our economic nest egg. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Was the nuclear seen as a way to, in effect, localize, you know, kind of feed into that system?
Yeah, well, there's several things. As long as you had the neat thing about the dams, you could put electric power other places, and you had already had the network of wires and so mm-hmm. forth. You didn't mm-hmm. have to spend a lot of money on that or for right of way to put stuff. We were also very vulnerable to the fact that we did not have an oil refinery, mm-hmm. and we were poorly served by oil refineries. We found that out in the 70s, in mm-hmm. 73, 72, 74, 5, we had problems with that, and so basically, there was one time we tried it. We put an LNG plant in Newport. That was a liquid natural gas. Mm-hmm. We had a liquid natural gas put out here on the Columbia River. Out towards St. Helens.
Yeah.
Not that far, but
yeah.
on the way to St. Helens. And we tried a lot of things like that, and then Trojan came. The idea of nuclear, I think, was not just to supplement hydro, but I think a lot of people thought that we would have a lot of nuclear plants and would probably would remove the vulnerability of the hydro, and mm-hmm. at some point, if we politically lost the ability to defend Northwest share of our dominance over the benefits of the hydro system, then the nuclear would take over. And the mistake, I think, probably that was made, and I think it's the one that Kelly Woods understood better than, and Kelly Woods, by the way, being the appointee that the Energy Department guy, but Mr. T is appointee for to be the top energy person, and he was with, but he was a pro-nuclear guy, and Ted Hollick, among other senators, were opposed to him. It was quite a nasty legislative issue. But anyway, the idea there was what Tilly always thought, and a mistake was made that the companies that were going to build nuclear plants, this is true across the country, by the way, across the whole country, was to build, let everybody, and every company that build has a plan or has a design to have a nuclear plant. Like the first, somebody would build a Westinghouse pressurized water reactor, and the next person had to build a General Electric boiling water reactor, and the next person would have to build a Gulf gas-operated nuclear reactor. And so there was probably five, maybe six different types, and the focus was going to be to build all six of them. The problem is they all six have different problems, and they all six did. Well, not one of them didn't, actually. The one that the gas one would have been, if somebody had decided, the one they built one in Colorado, and it was the only one that didn't have the problem with that Three Mile Island had, and so forth. And if they just decided on one design and it had a common repair and common maintenance idea for all of them, it would have been a lot cheaper, and it would have been more safe. It would have been safer, and it wouldn't have stirred the public concern as much. Mm-hmm. So I think the biggest mistake was the creators. I mean, the people that built them made the mistakes. I think they could have won the public over if they had done the right thing. Mm-hmm. But Tia was. He was pro-nuclear on the basis of what it could do. I mean, there were other people that had fascinations about geothermal and other kinds of energy sources. One of the exciting things was talked about was there was in Colorado, there was in Wyoming, in places in the Rockies, there was a thing called in situ development of oil shale, oil in the rocks. It was said to be that there was enough oil in that basin there, actually more oil there than there was in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And if we had found a cheap and environmentally reasonable way to get it, that we would have had our energy problem solved.
Yeah. Drive along, I think it's I-70 that goes through there. Yeah. And towards, right after the Utah-Colorado border.
Yeah, Fort St. Vrain.
There's a whole town there.
Yeah.
It's empty.
Yeah.
Because the price of oil never got high enough to justify.
Right.
But they built.
But they always said, one way of sarcastically putting it, was that whatever they decided, and whatever new toy they had, it was always a few cents higher than they could ever get it down to where we'd be competitive with something dirty like coal.
Yeah.
Coal was the worst. That was to me. I used to argue that, and I think Tia agreed with me on this one because of what happened in Denora, Pennsylvania. Is that coal kills people?
Yeah.
Up to that point, nuclear hadn't killed anybody.
Yeah. But, do you know when the Boardman plant was built?
When?
Yeah. Is that before this or after this?
No, it was before.
Okay.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Before this or after this? No, it was after.
Okay.
Yeah, it was after.
So that's kind of the first major coal that we see
Yeah. And they did a nice, it wasn't quite as awful as some of them, as the ones in West Virginia and places, mm-hmm. but it was, first of all, cleaner coal. But even the coal mines in the Rockies, the ones that Pacific Power and Light Company owned and stuff,
mm-hmm.
they really had to have those alterations of the smokestacks to make those things healthy.
Yeah.
But there was always this. In Oregon, as more than any of the other states, I think the environmental movement was a tough out. Some people just saw this as a limited growth ability, and a lot of people wanted it that way.
Mm-hmm.
It came from sort of the Tom McCall idea.
Yeah.
Let's not get too big here. You know.
Yeah.
There were many stories that Tia and I used to talk about and laugh about because we didn't think of, we laughed about them because it seemed so funny to us that people talking about what horrible things would happen if Oregon gained its population beyond a certain number.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite like the Club of Rome, kind of situation. Where you used to, when Bob Packwood, for example, Bob Packwood put in a law that never passed or anything that your third child would be taxed higher than the,
mm-hmm.
You could have two children sort mm-hmm. of tax free.
Mm-hmm.
The third one, you get hit hard, and
right.
fourth, and all of that. So it was a population limitation proposal, but it was like from the Club of Rome. There was always that was that era. We always had this concern about don't get too big, or you have to. And I have an. There was one anecdote that I learned. I'm stupid about this. Like when I moved here from Atlanta, Georgia, I had no idea about what a river power system was like and what hydro was like and.
Mm-hmm.
You live in an area like this, it had its natural resources all over the place. So I was sent out to cover a meeting of the Columbia River, what do they think it's called? It's called Columbia River. It involves six states.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the people who manage the Columbia River all the way up to the kind of Canadian line. And every year they'd meet, and all the interests that would, like the interest being recreation, fish, wildlife, power, the irrigation people, and flood control people, mm-hmm. everybody that had a stake in. Would come and argue how much acre feet of water they felt their interest needed in
right.
that coming year. Well, I'm sent up there to cover this thing, and I don't know anything about rivers or water or acre feet. I mean, it's just it's like sending a baby into I listened to the first part of the meeting, and I'm taking down notes. And at the end of each presentation. They would have, one of the experts would say, "Well, that's so for the." He'd give his estimate of the acre feet that interest that he was representing needed. I jotted that down. So lunchtime came. About four or five people had testified. I went up to the committee's the person who was chairman of the committee was Herb Lundy, the mm-hmm. editor of the editorial page of the Oregonian. Of course I knew. Didn't work for it at that point, but I knew. And he didn't know me yet, because I was a new reporter, pretty much, just in the 60s. And I said, I got a question, Mr. Lundy. What's that? How many acre feet are there in the Columbia River? And he gave me a number. Mm-hmm. I jotted it down, then went back to my seat. And then we listened to lunch. After lunch, they started, the next couple of people came and testified how many acre feet they needed. Finally, the meeting was over about 2:30, and I went back up to Herb, and I said, Mr. Lundy, yeah. Here's another question. You told me there were so many acre feet in the Columbia River. That's right. Did I put the number down right? Is this right? I said, yeah. Well, you know, the second person that testified this afternoon exceeded that number by 250 acre feet. So, if the best I can tell from this meeting, if you fulfilled all these requests, the river would be dry. Mm-hmm. He said, it's dry every year when you listen to it. That's what happens. We live with that. That's where we live in the Northwest, with people wanting more than we have to offer. And that, to me, in my mind, summed up that one meeting and education experience, signed up just exactly what we're dealing with in the Northwest in that whole era, mm-hmm. all across the board. And Vicente and everyone else that had to deal with the problem understood that they're going to be fighting and debating and having arguments with people over how much water they needed. Mm-hmm. Later on in life, I learned that this was more serious than even that meeting, because when we had Tia sponsored a law that would allow a portion of public water to be saved for public use. Mm-hmm. It was a small portion. And some farmers in eastern Oregon were really opposed to this. And didn't threaten much, but they were, I'm going to vote against it. And Atiyah was trying to get some of his colleagues to support him and winning their support. Anyway, I called one of them, and young guy, pretty young guy. I thought he'd be sounded pretty reasonable, quite educated. And I asked him, what is his view on this? He said, oh, this view's been settled. I said, really? You knew something I don't know? I said, well, it's settled in my mind. My great-grandfather and Mr. Jones's great-grandfather over here had a dispute about who's going to get certain water. And my great-grandfather shot him. And we settled it.
There you go.
So I see it gets to that point. So anyway, I guess I'm taking a long story short, but we were always living in this era with contention over too few resources to serve too many interests.
Right. So allocation
and if anything, Vicentia came into power, him as a governor, at a time when that was true across the board on everything, mm-hmm. money, mm-hmm. everything. I mean, mm-hmm. so he was, you might say, chosen to be the person that had to resolve or solve the problem of how do you take the too few resources to serve the mm-hmm. many people who wanted to be served. And when you have that situation, you're going to make enemies. Mm-hmm. The fact that he didn't make it that many enemies is startling when you come back and think about it. Mm-hmm. Normally, if you had a situation where a governor took over an era when you had recessions like that and power outages and so forth, you'd have a very unpopular governor who never would have served two terms, number one. Number two, would still be disliked mm-hmm. by a lot of people. The irony happened with Atiyah. Any dislike that he may have had or lack of respect during his time changed, I think, in my mind, has changed remarkably a few years later. He's now become a person amongst everybody who lived in that area and covered it, one of the great governors mm-hmm. we've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
For his management skills and his ability to be clairvoyant about the future and the consequences that could occur as certain things happen. A lot of people just don't see, a lot of governors I've covered, when they analyze something to do, they're never quite sure what the consequence is going to happen over here mm-hmm. in a certain area, other area governor. Because of his great experience as a ways and means person, and because of the fact that he had spent so many years figuring out budgets for agencies, he really knew when somebody would tell him we should cut this money across the board or something, he would know right away which agency would suffer the most and which agency could not afford any more cuts and which agency could take a few more. He actually is almost like, you could almost say he managed like somebody who had managed every one of those agencies.
Yeah.
He just had incredible wealth of knowledge about that stuff. And it almost should be something that's required to be governor now when you look back on it.
Mm-hmm.
As he was prepared to be that person. The governors that followed him, some of them who had good traits,
mm-hmm.
some of them who, you know, who had certain maybe better speaking skills, but none of them had the skill he had in managing state government.
Mm-hmm.
None of them. He's far succeeded all of those.
Question going back to Kelly Woods. You wrote a column about arms being twisted by the governor's office to try to get the Woods nomination through. And it said, you know, fails 15-15, they get people committee, you know, it's all over the place. And eventually Vic just appoints himself.
Right.
You know, to the board after Jim Redden says, you know, they can vote for any reason that they want to vote. That's
right,
the Senate's
right.
prerogative. But you write about arm twisting. Vic, in his talking with me and talking on his oral history, says he never did anything like that. Was this a Lee Johnson thing, do you remember? Or was it Vic laying down? You write specifically that people that you talked to in the Senate were saying, you know, they told me that if I support him, X will happen, and if I don't, that this bill that I want is going to be vetoed.
No, it was definitely Lee Johnson.
Okay.
I mean, it's not even a secret.
Okay.
I may not have, I don't recall the column, but I may not have named the names I should have. If mm-hmm. I didn't, it was probably because I had need to still have access to Lee and
mm-hmm.
for other reasons. But he had a reputation of doing that, not just on the Woods thing. That was his style that Governor Attia would constantly have to tone him down on.
Yeah.
Speaking of Redden, Jim Redden and Lee were friends, even though they were from different parties. But they had many fights like that over the fact that Lee would pull almost anything. I mean, he would sort of sometimes even threaten what we call today almost like an extortion to get mm-hmm. stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do this if, or I, you know, throw out warnings. And he was he'd do it with a smile.
Yeah,
but. And he was effective in some ways, but he also cost the governor, I think, some mileage. It took, some things might have been done a lot faster if the governor had just done it.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, rather than have Lee come in and pound away. There was a committee that called the Senate Energy and Environment Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the favorite committees of all time in the legislature because it had Ed Fadley was on that committee. John Powell was on that committee. Ted Halleck was on that committee. Ted Kulongoski was on that committee. L.B. Day was mm-hmm. on that committee, and the fellow that Vic knew from Hood River, who had been a pilot.
Ken Jesperson?
No. Vic went to his funeral here recently. He was sort of a quiet guy normally.
Gernstad?
Yeah, Ken Gernstad.
Yeah, there we go.
Gernstad. He was on a committee. Anyway, a lot of the press and media, and I was one of them, always had those meetings on a late afternoon, usually on a Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, mm-hmm. usually around 2:30 or 3 o'clock. We try to get all our work done and run down there, whether we're going to cover it or not, just to hear the arguments. I mean, it was stand-up comics, you know, a lot of them. But it was the one area where energy got discussed the most, and where Atiyah's, where the Kelly Woods thing got discussed the most, and the voice. One thing about the committee, even among the liberal left versus as well as the conservatives, there was a lot of brains there, and a lot of great. A lot of great one-liners were thrown out. As a writer, I love just listening to it. But that's the committee that got... That was the source, in my memory now, of the column about where somebody told me that Lee Johnson had been... what was the phrase?
Doing arm twisting.
Arm twisting, yeah.
Yeah.
That would be the committee that he'd be doing it with,
and
fatally probably, and Halleck would have been two of the people that were most anti. Mm-hmm. Halleck was a character in his own sense, and I don't know what he and Atiyah's relationship were, but they were both. They were both strong characters in terms of their articulation of subject matter and everything. Mm-hmm. That was a committee, though. That was a circus.
Yeah.
And it was definitely Lee Johnson. I mean, I don't ever remember Vic Atiyah proposing. In fact, it pissed me off a lot of times as a person, not who was favoring a certain topic, but if I favored something, it was to get over gridlock.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to see the state move forward, and get on to another topic, solve instead of having months and months of debate over something that seemed like it was never ending. So. One thing about Vic, he would not cave. He would put into gridlock longer than I would like to tolerate, because he wouldn't do some of those things that mm-hmm. were necessary to break it.
Mm-hmm.
And
you think it was a tactic? Do you think it was a personality thing?
No, I think he's just. I don't know how to compare him. If I were to compare him with a politician that I read or knew about, would be Harry Truman.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of the fact that Harry Truman was a Democrat, it was somebody who just refused to do things the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
The best example is on the property tax limitation measure. Mm-hmm. He felt he was elected to serve the state, both at first as a representative, senator, and then governor, by the people. And the people in that number voted for a tax, property tax break. He didn't think anybody should just with a rule of hand oppose it. He felt he should support what they say. So So when there was an opportunity in the two ballot measures to seek a situation in which we could eliminate both of them,
mm-hmm.
he refused to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I know he recognized it would save money for state for certain, you know,
mm-hmm.
but he would rather find other ways to manage state government within the limitations of what the money was available than to, what he could say, double cross the public. And I thought, you know, most every politician I've ever known would have chosen another strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he didn't choose that strategy at that moment in time, including with Jack Faust and some of the other Republicans, the fact that he wouldn't budge on a sales tax bothered some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they just thought he couldn't be coaxed into it. Even they had many, many meetings, many, many Republicans that I know who were friends with Tia and remain today supporters, talked to him about changing his view on that,
mm-hmm.
and he wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And to the life of me, I never understood why he wouldn't do it, because it would have solved a lot of the problems that he was struggling to solve in state. But the primary reason is, and it finally is that he felt the public has already spoken and they should get what they voted for.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the way the system works. That he was not anything. He was not there to it was not government for just some of the people, but it's for the majority of the people.
Yeah.
And so he learned the civics lessons that a lot of us, you know, like to ignore. But
mm-hmm.
but that's basically the way I see that system. But in the hindsight of all that, after we grew out of that, he's looked back on now as the person that, in that era, did manage to save so many things that others wouldn't have done. And his environmental side of him is the other thing that surprised people, I think,
mm-hmm.
particularly his work on the Deschutes River. That really helped him. I don't know if who among his cabinet people were the most influential in that, if it was Pat or somebody else, Pat Amodeo or somebody else, but When he started to put in programs to save the Deschutes River from losing its fish run and so forth, heads turned. I mean, a lot of people were just stunned that he'd go that far,
mm-hmm.
and that he had that kind of situation. But just a lot of things. He's just full of surprises. Surprises a lot of us in the media didn't really see at the time. I'd like to think we all would beat ourselves on the chest and like to think that we saw him in some way. I saw that I liked the man,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't necessarily like the policies. I had a different, as an editorial writer representing a paper that had an editorial agenda, an editorial agenda that I by and large agreed with. I didn't like some of the things he was doing. We wrote about that. A lot of my editorials opposed a lot of the things the reasons he was doing it were reasons I understood and respected. I just thought that they were too rigid,
mm-hmm.
at the time.
Mm-hmm.
At times, I always used to argue that the times demanded something more than just duty, you know. And he didn't waver. It was sort of like looking for a metaphor, but it's sort of like somebody steering a boat in a storm, you know. It's a really bad storm, and the smart thing is to dump the boat and come shore.
Mm-hmm.
And he took the other way out, and he figured he'd been through storms before and seen what storms do, and he some sort of weather it and save the boat. And that seems to be what happened. But as years went by, he left office and I continued to write editorials for a while, and then I retired. But each year I think about it and look at the other governors and I covered. He still stands out as somebody who managed the state better than anybody I'd covered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I would say had a stronger character than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And without being dull, without being boring, dull, or in fact, the thing I like best about him is his humor. I mean, you could say anything to him, and I did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I'm trying to watch my language here on your tape recorder.
There's all sorts of interesting things on these pieces. So.
He didn't like swearing, but
I'm
not a person who minds that very much. It's part of my vocabulary.
Yeah.
And he would look at me sort of sternly, and I would say something like, "Well, no, Governor, that's me. I mean, I'm sorry, but that's what happened when you're raised in Pennsylvania."
Exactly. Where it turns out there are a lot of Atiyahs.
Yeah.
A lot of people from his home village there.
But my only regret is, in years past, as I got immobile and not in great health, I haven't been able to get out. And so I don't know how many lunches we've sort of talked about, either talked about or postponed,
mm-hmm.
and never had.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd sort of planned to have some. I mean, almost there was one point where we talked about having a monthly lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Just he and me.
Yeah.
And to talk about what we're talking about now.
Yeah.
And never had it. Never did it. He showed up at my retirement party and gave a little talk about it. It scared me to death, by the way. retirement parties for newspaper people are not what you really want to have, because you're so afraid that people you liked, that you covered, will tell a story that makes it sound like you covered up for them,
mm-hmm.
or something, or mm-hmm. that you didn't tell the truth, or that you kept secret some major break in the news.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so afraid somebody would get up and tell a story about me, and it would involve I've seen it happen with Jerry Tippins, one of my colleagues. One of the legislators got up and said, "You could always count on Jerry Tippins if you ask him for a favor to keep something out of the paper, he'd do it." And I looked at his expression. I thought he was going to dry up. And I was so afraid. But Atiyah didn't do that to me, and I don't think he had grounds, But, you know, we had so many funny, laughing moments that he could have told a story in such a way that would make me look like I was somewhat prejudiced. And Barbara Roberts was there and did the same thing, and Goldschmidt was there. And Goldschmidt sent a letter, and then Kitzhaber came. So I had quite a few governors take a shot at me.
Mm-hmm.
And I've dodged every bullet. It was sort of amazing.
Uh-huh.
But Vic was, at that point on, we talked about getting together. We did get together a couple times. I think I mentioned to you earlier that one Sunday morning, to my surprise, I got a call. One of his colleagues told me to meet him at a Fred Meyer store. He had a motorhome, and we all went to Seattle to see the Green Bay Packers play. And Vic particularly asked that I come along. And we went up there, and Vic got a chance to go in to meet Bart Starr, quarterback of the Packers. And, of course, as most people know, or if they read my story afterward, Vic was, when he was a college football player at Oregon State, he got a contract to play for the Packers for something, for a small amount of money, I might say, but he still had a copy of the contract, and we printed that contract. But he got a chance to go in and, as a once Packer, once possible Packer, he got a chance to meet Bart Starr, and I've never seen his expression. He was so... He's like a little boy. It's, you know, it's the first time I've ever seen him intimidated. Intimidated by the fact that Bart Starr of the Green Bay Packers was treating him like a king. And he talked about it all the way back and talked about football. But...
Tell me the story. You said that Bart Starr was really the only person who really awed Vic.
Yeah. You mean odd him?
The other way around.
Yeah. Well, it was, it sort of caught Starr by surprise, I think, even though he'd been a Packer. He was now, my memory is that he was now either, I don't think he was the quarterback. I'll have to go back and think about this. He may have been just becoming the, just leaving as the quarterback, it was like his last year or so, or he was on the coaching staff. But he would, but the point is, the very fact that a governor of a state, which was one of a colleague, so to speak, as a Packer, thrilled him. And it was just, you know, and he was awed by the fact that here's a governor of a state, former Packer, coming in and. In the locker room, he was, and then I myself had mentioned to Starr, having been a former sports writer, I knew the lingo, that about Vic's successes as in politics, and the reason he didn't play for the Packers, because he had told me that earlier, about the fact that he had to work with the his family's rug company, and he didn't have the opportunity to take a gamble at going to summer camp for 50 bucks, you know. And anyway, Bart was he kept asking other people afterwards, other people in our group, stuff about a Tia, because he wanted to, and he asked for a Tia's autograph. Should have been vice versa, even, because a Tia clearly wanted his autograph. I don't know, I don't think he asked for it, but he clearly wanted it. They gave him a football with an autograph on it, and they gave him a Packer shirt. I forgot if it was Starr's shirt or someone else's, but Starr wanted Tia's autograph. Bart Starr was a pretty smart guy too. I mean, he wasn't like one of these football jocks who just never learned anything. But the Packers were still a good team then. The Seahawks were not. And so it was the other benefit of the trip. The right team won the game. From a TS point of view. I enjoyed it myself, but they talk about being, I guess, the person most shocked, or not shocked, but most thrilled by that whole moment was me, just to be called to go up there with him. I felt privileged to be to have the governor of state. I mean, I'm not an autograph seeker either, but to have the governor of state call me on a Sunday out of the blue, I wasn't his favorite person, I didn't think, to go to a football game to see his alma mater pro team play was really a flattering.
I can relate. Vic asked me to write this book.
I was flattered. I was, you know, no question about it. Well, he's sincere, no question about it. He got a big kick, I think he got a big kick out of me initially when I first came in with my, I told him that I, he kept, Denny Miles, who you we both know well and like, kept bragging about Atiyah's volunteer group, how many signs they had, how many people made calls on the weekends, and it got to be almost overmuch. I mean, I kept asking how he felt he could even the number with at Straub so forth, and he'd tell me all these numbers. So the first time I went down to his office, when I didn't do it until he first mentioned himself, out of his mouth, not Denny's, that he had all these volunteers. And I said, well, you know, no disrespect, Senator, but I'd like to take a look at some of those volunteers myself. Fine, he said. I've got cabinets over here with all the names and numbers. You just go ahead and take what you want. So I went in and I pretended I knew what I'd planned to do, but I just went in and I think I took a couple things out of the B's and I went down and got a couple D's and I went down and got just letters throughout their alphabetic thing and got about 10 to 12, I just don't have a great memory. I'd say a dozen, maybe. And out of that, I called every one of them. I had interviews with every one of them. And I do remember that the large majority, like 10 or 9 or 10 of the 12, or if it was 10, it was 7 of the 10, were not only... They were not only active volunteers, but they actually did telephone stuff, and they went out on weekends. They did, and they had signs in their yard. They had all three things I was asking about. Mm-hmm. And the other ones that didn't had one or at least one of those three things. They either had the worst one, just had a sign in the yard. Mm-hmm. They didn't go on any volunteer. Mm-hmm. So you could almost say that was not a volunteer.
Yeah.
But the other, so the other 11 would have had at least been on the phone and a sign in the yard. Had a sign in the yard, been on the phone, or gone on a weekend rally kind of thing, or done something like that. Three of them, my memory, three or four of them didn't have a sign in the yard, but did the other things, which are even more impressive. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have a sign in the yard because they lived in an apartment.
Yeah.
And by the way, they weren't all from Portland either. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. I would put back if I got two or three or four from Portland, I would figure that was enough, and I'd put back, I'd get right and make sure I had somebody from the valley, and somebody from Eastern Oregon, somebody from the coast, somebody from Southern Oregon, try to split it around.
Yeah.
And I had a couple from Medford, I know, and one from Coos Bay. But I used to have a story, and I couldn't find it in my filing, in my files. It listed who they were.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't just do it. I actually wrote about it.
Yeah, I'll look for that then.
Because I never... It's my style, is I never do that much work without writing about it.
Exactly. Exactly.
But that's what he talked about at my retirement party. I mean,
uh-huh.
He was very, very heartfelt for me. I loved that anecdote to hear it. I loved other people to hear that
mm-hmm.
I did that.
Mm-hmm.
That was the way I weighed his boast of with the truth, is to investigate it.
Mm-hmm.
But he was great. He was Paul Phillips was then his driver.
Yeah.
During that campaign.
Vic's nephew Ed had been the driver through the primary, and then Paul came on.
Yeah.
And Ed, who's not a political guy, loved the time with his uncle, but was so happy that Paul Phillips came in.
Yeah.
Somebody who likes to do this.
I'll never forget. I used to go on these trips with guys. I went on a campaign trip with Wendell Wyatt. And just, I loved to watch the styles of these guys. And Wendell would stop. He'd have the driver stop in a town. He'd walk into a store, and he'd go up, and he'd shake hands with everybody in the store. And just introduce himself and so forth. And then Wendell would get back in the car, and we'd go on and off, and Wendell would, Wendell was actually a funny guy. He had a lot of satiric, a lot of satire in him. He'd say, he'd get out of, we'd head to the next town, and Wendell would say, I wonder if they'll ever remember me. I wonder what they'll say about me in that town years from now.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget. I shouldn't say this. I'm going to say it. What the hell? We stopped at one spot. Wendell was not a big fan of the of Mark Hatfield in terms of Mark being sort of a prude.
Mm-hmm.
So we were driving. I think we were going toward the coast, and we. Some small town on the way to the coast. I've forgotten what town now, but we stopped anyway at a corner. And Wendell points up to the road and to his driver and says, up here, there's a corner spot up here you can stop. It's where Mark Hatfield used to stop and get on his knees and pray. And he just always come up with these little funny
uh-huh.
things that showed his total disrespect for yeah. somebody that he thought was a phony. That's
yeah.
really what it was.
Yeah.
But if we were talking about Mark Hatfield now, I'd add to that that there's another guy that surprised me. Mark Hatfield was a prude, and to me was somebody that I really didn't like at all until his senior years in the Senate, when I thought he was fabulous.
Yeah.
I think he made a personality change. He transitioned into a guy you really wanted to be around at the end of his career.
Mm-hmm.
He's another guy. He didn't come to my retirement, but he called me the day afterwards and said he wanted me to come down and have lunch with him. Sort of a post-retirement lunch, and we to talk about my future. I said, my future's, I'll tell you what that's going to be like. I tell you right now. But anyway, he's another one that I ended up, I did a lot of energy stuff, and he,
mm-hmm.
yeah, he respected that. But he's somebody who unlike Atiyah, I respected all the way, but didn't particularly think he was doing as well as I later thought, later mm-hmm. just determined that he was one of the best at doing. Hatfield, I just thought, was a prude, somewhat of a phony, Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be, it surprised me in the sense that it turned out to, I had a different view of him later on.
Yeah.
This may have been me. It may have been me that had the different view. He may have been the same guy, but it was comfortable to know that Wendell Wyatt felt the same way.
You covered the 78 election pretty closely. And there's a lot of Straub and Attia campaigned hard against each other. I mean, they weren't afraid to take shots in debates. They were pushing each other pretty hard. And then later on, Vic is asked to be part of the board of the Attia or the Straub archives, and Vic writes the intro for the Straub biography. I was talking with Ted Kulongoski earlier this week, and Ted's relationship with Vic was a good relationship. I mean, they disagreed on issues. But Ted said, you know, after that 82 campaign, it's not that we were angry at each other, but we just didn't have anything to do with each other. You know, they just went off. And then Ted kind of came back. When Ted was governor, Ted would get on the phone and call Vic and say, you know, can I talk to you about this kind of stuff? And they got really close the last 10 years of Vic's life. From your position, watching campaigns like that, especially that 78 one, did you see any evidence that they made it personal and then things would calm down later? Or, you know, how did that...
Between
Straub and Attia. Are they playing, you know, the roles that they know that they have to play? Or
Straub had a short fuse.
Uh-huh.
He sort of had a temper. He wasn't as forgiving on anything. If he had an enemy and on an issue, it was hard for him to get over that person not being an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
I think I could say this. My brother-in-law ran for governor against Straub,
mm-hmm.
and Betty Roberts, mm-hmm. the three of them,
yeah.
Primary. Straub won. I think Straub won the election, obviously, but Straub and Redden weren't even they were Democrats and they were both state treasurers, they turned out, you know, were not comfortable with one another from then on out. But it wasn't my brother so much, brother-in-law, that was that way. It was Straub. He was an enemy in the campaign, so he was an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's some of that mm-hmm. in what you're saying as far as any situation during that campaign. Anything Tia would have said that would be critical criticism of Straub's administration or how he ran things or him himself would have been taken personally,
mm-hmm.
and more than people do when they're in campaigns.
Yeah.
Not much a pro, not very professional in that, as far as running campaigns are concerned. On the other hand, Straub, I'm not very good at this one because on all circumstances, I was never an admirer of anything Straub did. I'm the one person on our editorial board I wasn't involved in any of Straub's elections, but I didn't vote for him, I'll put it that way. I thought he was an egotist.
Mm-hmm.
He had a superiority complex to a lot of on all kinds of issues. I think he was a smart guy. Like he had, but I just don't think. I don't know who his friends were.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly weren't the people in politics, I could tell. I can't really relate. If you were asking me a question, who were Straub's allies in politics? Who were his friends in politics? After he was elected, who were his chief backers? Were I know who the people who gave him money were in mm-hmm. many cases, and I know who his friends and family were, but I don't recall that he had anybody, or had I talked to anybody, that would say, "Well, I really liked Bob Straub when he was governor. I really wanted Bob Straub to be this or that." I just find it been hard for Bob Straub to have had a relationship. It's surprising he had a relationship at all with an opponent after his, even though he won.
Mm-hmm.
It's like somebody like, it's almost like if you had a bad time on a rainy day, you don't like rain anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
But all these other, one thing I always like about, many things about Oregon politicians, is that, particularly Republicans and Democrats, is that they always, unlike what happened in the national sense, they always seem to get along well.
Mm-hmm. There's ups and downs with that, but
yeah.
Much less partisan than other places.
Right. Tony Meeker was great with the Democratic leadership, and mm-hmm. My brother-in-law, I know, was really good with Republicans. Lee Johnson is the example I gave you earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Kulongoski, I think, was pretty good that way. I'm not sure about Goldschmidt.
Yeah, he's kind of the exception because it's like he swung in on a vine to be governor. He had, it was mayor of Portland.
If you were doing a book on Goldschmidt, I could fill your day.
Well, there's Nigel Jaquist at Willamette Week has been toying with it for a long time, but we all know that Neil's not going to talk to Nigel, so.
Yeah. I wrote the book. I wrote a thing on Neil for the, I was asked to do it for Oregon Encyclopedia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I did the Vic one.
They couldn't get anybody to do it, and so yeah. I did it. And I covered him pretty closely. But he's the example I always give about the difference between his office and Dick's. And you'd have to basically get a passport to get in to see Goldschmidt.
Yeah. I talked to Vern Duncan, who's a good friend, and Vern had his first cabinet meeting with McCall just before McCall left. And then Straub, Atiyah, all the way up. And so Vic was saying with Straub's staff, you could talk to Straub and you could talk to the staff, and whatever Straub said, there was a good chance that it would come to fruition. When you talk to Vic, whatever you talk to Vic about, the staff would be on it, it would happen. There's no question whatsoever. And when you talk to Neil, you couldn't talk to Neil. You couldn't even get to see him.
Right.
And so it was just a different planet then.
I'll tell you this story. It won't help you on this one, but you'll like to hear it because you love politics. I got a call from Neil Goldschmidt when he was working for Nike in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asked to think about running for governor. And I'm trying to remember how this works now. I'll start with this. I got a call from Neil. They wanted to have breakfast. I my eyes don't open until 10 o'clock. Mm-hmm. I don't think much until 1. Mm-hmm. And just to let you know, everything you read in those clippings, almost everything, I can't swear to every one of them, but almost everything was written in the PM. Mm-hmm. I don't write in the mornings. I don't think in the mornings. I stay up every night till 2 or 3, mm-hmm. and I wake up. I have to be at work at 9 or something, but I never. I'm just numb, so I never scheduled any breakfast. But anyway, he called and wanted breakfast, and so I go down there, and we have breakfast at the one of the hotels on Broadway. And his son's with him. He had his son with him. And he starts, first thing he did, he said, I asked you here today because I know you covered the legislature, and I'm thinking about running for governor. And I want to know what your thoughts are about how that works best. How does a governor work best with the legislature, and what you have to do? And I remember that's the only time I talked, mm-hmm. that one time, mm-hmm. I answered the question as well. I said, you're used to, as a city mayor, you're used to calling in 5 people, and you've got to get 3 of them, mm-hmm. just to agree with you. That's all you have to do. Mm-hmm. You don't have to see anybody else. Mm-hmm. You just call in, you get 3 people. Admitting there's sometimes tough sells, mm-hmm. but you get 3 people to agree with you and it's over. The legislature, different. That's if you've got to get 16 people in the Senate, mm-hmm. at least, and in the House, so the 31, yeah. 31 in the House. There's 31 people in the House from different parts of the state, different agendas, and in the Senate you have to get 16, same thing, only with less opportunity to influence or blackmail, because they have 4-year terms, mm-hmm. and you can't scare them into their next election problem. Mm-hmm. And I said, so it's different. So then he spends the next hour and 15 minutes, because I was late for work, talking about himself and what he hopes to accomplish and what his dreams and hopes and so forth are. Mm-hmm. Never once ever asking me one other question about the legislature or what I think about him running, mm-hmm. or anything. Mm-hmm. And this is his idea of... I think this was his idea of reaching out and collecting an opinion.
Right. And, do you remember, was this before the 86 election? The reason I ask is, Vic told me, and also in his oral history, Vic wanted to take him on in 1982. That would have been his ideal opponent.
Yeah. He would have had a good shot at beating him. Mm-hmm. Tell you the reason. One reason why he would have had a good shot at beating him is sort of an unfair reason. I don't think Vic would have even used it or mentioned it. Goldschmidt had this aura about, with most people in the Portland metropolitan area at least, as being like coming in on a white horse. Mm-hmm. He had this. Because of what happened downtown and the way the city was managed and Metro and all the things he did, progressive things he did downtown among the progressive left of left, mm-hmm. voter. I mean, I've never seen a left wing like a left wing in Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he voted for McGovern. I mean, you know. This is as Democratic an area as it ever been in history, in my mind. But anyway, he he was thought of as sort of like coming in on a great white horse. Like Camelot. Mm-hmm. He was the Camelot guy, I guess. And when you do that, you come in and you have such awful results. It's such a huge disappointment. You're just so badly disappointed in your base and the people who really love your ass. Mm-hmm. I mean, disappointment is not... It's really amazing how much... it's not just the sellout part stuff. I mean, it's... You know, a lot of people had that concern, but he went to Nike and learned how to please business. And he was the car people loved him. And I went back and spent a month interviewing all the people in the automobile industry, Estes of General Motors and Caldwell of Ford and the heads of every car company, and they loved him because he followed the guy that wanted to reinvent the automobile.
Yeah.
And what Goldschmidt did for them, he promised them and did deliver on having, when they had a problem with government of any kind, any agency, he would line everybody up that they needed to see, get them all in one room so they could have one visit to Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. one day, mm-hmm. spill it out and go home. Mm-hmm. Didn't have to spend a week there, didn't have to, you know.
Yeah.
He made life so much easier on them. There was almost a point that where some of them, when Reagan took over, were recommending that they keep him, mm-hmm. believe it or not. Mm-hmm. But Reagan keep Goldschmidt because yeah. he was so good as a U.S. In fact, transportation secretary is probably his greatest success.
Yeah.
Before I continue this, because I have something else to say. My wife left three sodas back in the other room. There's ice in the refrigerator,
okay,
if you
thanks.
Like. There's this, mm-hmm. and there's Coke, and there's orange.
Okay. No, I'm fine right now. But
yeah. No, okay.
Yeah, that's good. Thanks.
I meant to say that earlier. Anyway, so on that lunch, on that breakfast, I went back and just walked all the way up that street to the Oregonian building and said to myself, I can't believe it. He didn't ask me one other goddamn thing. I mean, you can tell from talking to me today and reading my notes, I have plenty to say.
Yeah.
I've never been short on opinion. And so I don't know what he was quite looking for. We'd had some personal experiences together when I was the reporter who covered, there was a guy that was bombing power towers. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, and he threatened the Portland water system and everything. Mm-hmm. Well, I was a reporter that first one that sort of discovered that same guy that was doing that to the towers was also threatened the water system. Mm-hmm. And so Goldschmidt, I went to talk to Goldschmidt about it, and he finally took me in to his confidence, and I went back to my papers. I'm going to write the story no matter what he says, because I've got enough facts. And my editor, Dick Noakes, said, well, this will panic everybody in the town. So let's play ball with them a little while. Let's give them a deadline. You get your strategy involved in how you're going to deal with this, and we're going to write a story. We'll give them a week or something like mm-hmm. that. And But Goldschmidt was, because of our willingness, that wasn't my willingness, but I'm a nastier person than that, but their willingness to put off a week talking about that threat, he had a respect for me that probably wasn't earned, but at least that's what started, that's why he called, and so forth. And also, my trailblazer and stuff involved, I remember going back to Washington with David Halberstam. We traveled for a week with the Blazers in 1979, and I took a week's vacation to do it, and we spent a couple, spent a night, a day or something with Goldschmidt when he was, wasn't 70, 79, yeah.
79, he would have been there.
Yeah, he was secretary. By the way, I think it was, that's what I was stumbling over when he was, in the time frame, when he was secretary, transportation, I think, is when he really got the corporate bug. I mean, when it really changed from the heartthrob of the liberals, left wing, because he was playing too much to corporate types, and became a big friend of business. That's what they sort of thought, and and I think it's probably true. He saw that where the money was, and I don't know if he started out to be a bad person, but he ended up being somewhat of a bad person. But not because of the rape. It's just because of some of the change in his philosophies. But anyway, his office was hard to get in. To his office. Barbara Roberts was different. She's friendly, but she's very partisan. Very incredibly partisan. She hated Kitzhaber. Still does. Unbelievable. How, you know, they, of course, he was nasty with her. So you know. And Kitzhaber, I know an awful lot about him because I. Of all the people who ran for governor, including Atiyah, I spent more personal time with Kitzhaber than anybody. We wrote songs and stuff together, and wrote new lyrics, satirical lyrics for political happenings when he was a state senate president. His fiancée at that time was
Stephanie
Fowler was one of our best friends.
Still
is. Although she's gone through some bad times lately. She had breast cancer. She's still getting treated. But Stephanie has a similar view to me about Vic. She's another one that covered him both as Channel 6 and Channel 8. And she may be the first one that said it to me from the media. I think she may have been. She went to that meeting you mentioned on the phone. She went to that meeting. We went to Jack Faust's house when he talked about the dog, your uncle's.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Jack, with Jack Walker's dog,
She was there.
Oh, yeah.
She and I were there at that.
Yeah.
At that, I wrote that column from that, but we were the only media people there. She was a big fan of Biggs. I don't know if she liked her or not.
I know Denny thinks that she was really critical while Vic was in office. I definitely want to talk to her. If you have contact information, I'd love to have
that. Yeah, I got it, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the last thing about Goldschmidt. I don't think... He put it this way, he disappointed me. I took it from my colleague Larry Hildebrand, I thought Goldschmidt had done a wonderful job as mayor. And I know nothing about, I never covered City Hall, and so I can't really talk about that. I do know that to get something done in the city, is nothing like getting something done in the state. I mean, it's just...
It's pretty focused. You know who's up, who's down, and there's, as you said, there's only five of them.
Yeah, right. Get three.
Get three and you're done.
You don't even care about the other two.
I mean, yeah.
But, you know, there's a chance for bargaining. It's limited.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you're not a bargainer, I mean, you know, Goldschmidt would be more of a guy like Lee Johnson. He'd extort your vote.
Mm-hmm.
He would say, you know, you wanted this such and such, and it's not going to happen unless you do this.
Mm-hmm.
It would be his style.
Yeah. Yeah. I know when Vic came in, Bob Straub had left him, in effect, a list. This is what, you know, governors do, and here's how I've done it. And the first thing Vic did, his very first official act, was an extradition. He was stunned by how much extradition stuff there was when you're governor. You never hear about it, but there's just a whole bunch of that kind of stuff that happens. And then Vic, in fact, you wrote a column about it. Heads did not roll when Vic was in. He kept a lot of the Straub people, you know, head of this agency or department and that kind of thing. And partly because he had just a tremendous respect for state employees. And he worked with them in Ways and Means. So then at the end, when he leaves, he does the same thing for Goldschmidt. And Goldschmidt not only fired everybody, it's like he took the list and threw it away. And just did completely different things.
Except for my wife.
There you go.
He appointed her to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission.
Uh-huh.
And Goldschmidt gave her a second term.
Oh, great.
Goldschmidt walked in that door
uh-huh.
at a Christmas party that I had. Looked down on all my land, 3 acres.
Uh-huh.
There was no houses down there then. We owned an acre and a half down there. He says, "Is there water down there?" I said, "What do you mean?" He says, I was looking at a city map and it looked like there's a stream down there.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "No, I think it's maybe in a heavy rainstorm, but I think it's in a creek." He says, "I'm going to look into it because if there is, we're going to get a sewer in here. Which is going to cost," and he did.
Uh-huh.
He's an invited guest in my house. He ended up, sees it for the first time, and a few years later, I'm selling the land because I can't afford the sewer.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot.
This is Vic talking about the Goldschmidt people. So.
Her, but her husband is a senator. I know very well. He was very well known, nice guy, I like him. She went to work for my successor.
Mm-hmm.
A few months after I saw her, she said, "This job is tougher than you made it look." And that's a particularly highlight.
That's a very telling and wonderful.
But there was another one.
Who is this?
I think I've nailed it down, but I'm not quite sure who it is yet. But that's Vic, you know, talking about her. But that may become the title of the book. But that's, you know, the in effect, the assuredness or cockiness of the Goldschmidt people. And it's like, you know,
yeah,
there's a lot of stuff that goes along with this.
Well, we had, he's sort of crazy. We invited Goldschmidt to spend a weekend with us at the beach
mm-hmm.
when he was mayor. And we stopped at a restaurant on the way down on Friday night. He was tight. He was all just really tight. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Wound up, is what I'm trying to say,
mm-hmm.
like a spring. And the waitress had a piece of lemon pie that he liked you like this lemon pie. So did his wife. And she wanted the lemon pie, and he said, I'm gonna have it. I'm sorry, I like lemon pie. And we're sort of laughing about it, you know. And I like lemon pie too, but there's lemon pie somewhere else. I'll get. Anyway, we're having all this talk about lemon pie, and then getting into discussion about ethics and the idea of if it's ethics, if it's selfish to let your friends have what they want, because that it's selfish because you're turning the light on yourself as being someone who's willing to share. Mm-hmm. And so far, we're all having all this. Next thing I know, before I can stop, Goldschmidt is chasing his wife around the restaurant room. She's got the pie in a plate.
He's trying to get the pie.
He's chasing her all around the room. And we don't know. They're out of control. She goes in the women's room. He goes in after her.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first one. And they're laughing about it. I mean, there didn't seem to be any anger, but it was just like they were having this children's like game. And we're older than they are, of course. And but they came out and finally had some comment that she'd settle it, and he was eating the pie. He got in the lemon pie. Spent the whole weekend. He didn't, you know. He talked about himself. He talked about my beach house. Talked about his brothers having a place nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally on Sunday night, we're about to go home. He finally loosened up to where he started to be an interesting. He finally wound down to the point he finally be what maybe the real Goldschmidt was. And we stopped and had a late dinner with the owner of, what's her name? The one that has that great, in Newport, that great fish house.
Moe's?
Moe's.
Yeah.
Mo, whatever her name is.
Yeah.
He knew her well from somewhere. And we stopped in her home, not at her beach, stopped at her home, and had late dinner at Mo's. Mo didn't get back to Portland until about 1 in the morning. And at that point, you know, Malou and I thought that he was pretty interesting guy and weird, but, you know, had been very self-centered, but in a funny way, and certainly smart.
Yeah.
No, never an argument with me about his intelligence. Mm-hmm. He's a very smart guy. But he's obviously his parents loved him to death and made him think he was king of these, being so he was spoiled that way, but from that, except for that moment, that weekend at the beach, and the relationship I had briefly with him when about the towers being blown up, and that breakfast with his son, I didn't have any other really things to say, and yet Spencer Hines and some other people at the Oregon Inn thought that I was just. Had this special relationship with Neil Goldschmidt.
Mm-hmm.
Three things.
Yeah.
In his whole career. I to this day don't know what and his issue came up and all that. I never heard from him.
Mm-hmm.
I called his office and expressed not my sympathy, but. Told him I'm sorry. This he let this this himself let this happen to him, and that if he wanted to talk about it, I was free to talk about it. But I didn't say why. I mean, you know, I didn't offer support like I'm for you or to hell with your babysitter. I don't know what to say at times like that, but I don't wish things like that on anybody. But he was a I can measure from my own senses here that he was just a disappointment to a lot of people. Kulongoski, I got to know really well too, from his days as the insurance commissioner, and he's very media oriented, more than a lot of the governors were. He went down to the press room all the time, and so with the Republicans, all the Republicans. Norma Paulus and I had a really relationship. It was good. David Frohmeyer just died. He's another one who because of Henny Willis and so forth. He'd come down there quite a bit and we'd talk. Lee Johnson came in there quite a bit. He didn't hesitate to use the media if he could. Vic didn't do that. And I could say that. Vic was probably a of all the people, and I stayed in Salem, so I was in the media office all the time. It wasn't like just in the editorial board. As I told you earlier, I was assigned to Salem. So I covered it both as a political reporter and then later as an editorial writer, and then the whole time I was in the Salem office. So of all the governors from Mattia, Straub, as I say, I wasn't there for Straub, but Tia to Goldschmidt to Roberts to Kulongoski to Kutzhaber. Every one of those governors, except for Tia, we would see at some point in the day, usually, almost every day, if not every other day, in the media room. We didn't see Vic there. And the reason we didn't see him there is because you could walk into his office the same way as we walk into ours. The others, you couldn't do that. So
that's what Chuck Banks was telling me as well. Walking down the hall, talk to the governor, go up to
So
his
I think
office.
It was sort of like, I don't need to go to them. They know they can come up here and walk in. And not just walk. I mean, walk in is, it's just walking in is one thing. It's walking through that room, passing by the secretary that was usually there, walking through the door, not waiting for it to open, not waiting for somebody to say, "Who do you want?" Walking back to his where the governor sat. It's on the left-hand side. Just as you walk in, that was that way then. And tapping lightly on the door. If it was closed, you'd tap lightly on the door. If it was not, you just tap lightly and walk in. He'd be on the phone, or he'd be working, or he'd be, and he'd say something like, if he's working or on the phone, he'd sometimes say, "Sit down," and then go back to doing what he's doing. And then he'd finish, and, he didn't hide. He wasn't hiding anything. He wasn't embarrassed to be, it wasn't any sense of intrusion. I mean, it's almost like he was respecting us as much as he's respecting his own people. It goes a long way with media, believe me. Media has, and I'm a big example of it, media has big egos. I mean, our egos grow as our stories grow. And so when you're treated with respect by people who have been elected by the citizens as their leader, it resonates. You get little, you don't ask for autographs, but you get little chills up your spine. And he just treats you with respect. That's what it's all about.